the title, which I proposed for this evening's discussion, is actually fairly straightforward. And actually, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to pass out a single handout which contains three of the four introductions which we are going to be discussing. The fourth one has no handout because it's my own. And it will be my own presentation of certain themes which I will develop after going through the comments of the exegetes whom you have in front of you. The question of why introduce a biblical book, why write an introduction to a commentary, is perhaps unusual. In general, historically, we have studied books of Tanakh in a fairly straightforward fashion. We start at Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, and we go to the end, and we finish that book, and we turn to the next book, and we study that book from beginning to end. In the case of Torah, when we finish all five books, we go back to the beginning. So in a sense, the need for introduction, the need for overview, is something which we don't always perceive, we don't always sense, by virtue of the methodology of study which has been prevalent for a very, very long time. All right, does everybody have a handout? Everybody has? Okay. What makes the question, I think, perhaps very interesting in the cases of the books of Torah is the very fact that we can speak on the one hand of Sefer Torah, the book of the Torah, term which is actually found in the Torah, and at the same time we can speak of Chamisha Chumashei Torah. We can speak of the five elements, the five fifths, the units out of which Torah is composed. From the standpoint of the counting of the books of Tanakh, of course, the Chamisha Chumashei Torah are five separate units. They're five discrete literary entities. And we have to ask ourselves, if they are discrete literary entities, what do the divisions mean? What characterizes the divisions? And how does our perception of the books of the Torah as structurally separate from one another help us in our understanding of the content, the concepts within those Sfarim? Furthermore, the ability to step back, not to look narrowly and closely at the text, but rather to look at a larger portrait, a larger picture, will enable us to see things, perhaps very important things at times, which we miss when we study chapter by chapter, pasuk by pasuk, in a systematic and somewhat atomistic fashion. This is why introduction and overview are valuable. It's an attempt to view the whole, not to view the parts, because it is indeed so easy to be caught up in the details. And certainly the getting caught up in details is something which, for example, if we take something as fundamental as Pirush Rashi, it is very easy to get caught up in the details, pasuk by pasuk, along with the classic commentary, let's say, of Rashi, of Rashbam, of Ibn Ezra. All of them, in writing their commentaries, are focused fairly narrowly. They're not looking at what I call the big picture, the larger picture, the major units. They tend to be fairly either verse-oriented or even phrase and word-oriented, occasionally perhaps section-oriented, but that's not all that common. Those Rishonim generally confine their comments to a much narrower point of view. And as a result, they are not the Rishonim whom we will be subjecting to scrutiny this evening. What we will be looking at are three exegetes who do tend to look at the larger picture, unlike those whom I've just mentioned. Ramban, who lived in the 13th century, and perhaps is the culmination in many ways of the Spanish traditional of Parshanut HaMikra, although Abravanel or Abarbanel, who lived in the 15th century, could perhaps give us an argument as to how we would define the culmination, but certainly the two of them, more than other Rishonim, are the ones who have a tendency to be willing to look at the larger picture, to look at the larger Sefer, and to comment on not merely the small details. The third exegete at whom we'll be looking, a much more recent commentator, the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin in the late 19th century, is also in the tradition, in many ways, of Ramban, more so than in the tradition of Abarbanel, but in the tradition of Ramban, and he too, with the unique challenges that the late 19th century posed to traditional biblical study, Netziv also focuses at times on very large issues and not merely on the little ones. What characterizes sometimes the willingness to focus on the larger issue is the attempt to preface one's commentary to the biblical book with an introduction. An introduction which will lay out, as we shall see in a moment, that which the exegete sees to be important in the biblical book, that which he may see as its contents, its theme, its goal, and so on. Needless to say, we will find this very fruitful for our own thought processes, and I, of course, will use the three introductions at which we are going to look as the springboard for some of my own remarks, which will follow them. And we'll see that we all know, after all, we've all heard Sefer Bamidbar read in shul many times. I'm sure that we are all familiar to a greater or lesser degree with the contents of the book, and it is that very knowledge which will enable us to ask perhaps now and then a penetrating question, wondering why it is that a given commentator, whether early or late, either included something in his introduction that we might have considered fairly unimportant, or on the contrary may have left something out of his summary which we thought was absolutely essential and belonged. And these summaries really will skew our pictures of the book, and that's exactly what I want to see, at least in the first part of our discussion. So without further ado then, let's take a look at the introduction of Ramban. Again, if there are those who don't have, I've got more handouts here. Let's take a look at the introduction of Ramban to the book of Bamidbar. And Ramban, of course, takes as his starting point the fact that Sefer Bamidbar follows Sefer Vayikra. Achar shebe'er Torat HaKorbanot baSefer HaShlishi, after he finishes, the Torah finishes the laws regarding sacrifice in Vayikra, Hitchilata lesader baSefer HaZeh haMitzvot shenitztavu b'inyan Ohel Moed. The Torah begins to organize in this of the five books the commandments which the Israelites had been commanded regarding the tabernacle, the Ohel Moed, because after all, Korbanot and Ohel Moed do have a certain connection, a certain relationship with one another. Ukvar his here, al tumat mikdash v'kadoshav ledorot. The Torah has already specified certain laws regarding the prevention of impurity in the temple, ledorot, for future generations. And now ata yagbil et hamishkan biyoto bamidbar kasher higbil har sinai biyot hakavod sham. The Ramban spends most of his introduction focusing on the earliest part of Sefer Bamidbar, the part that deals with the preparation of the Ohel Moed for its use in the desert and for its travels through the desert. And he compares, and he frequently makes this comparison, the Ohel Moed, surrounded by the Kohanim and surrounded by the Leviim, is compared to Har Sinai, which was the center of the Israelite experience at the time of Matan Torah. And you'll see here, he's going to make a number of comparisons with the rules and regulations about approaching Har Sinai, and the rules and regulations about approaching the Mishkan, approaching the Ohel Moed. We're told that a non-Kohen who approaches the part of the Mishkan which is prohibited to him is going to be put to death. Kasher Amar Sham, as the Torah said regarding Har Sinai, he will be stoned. We're commanded that the even the Levites, Leviim, are not to go in while the Kohanim are wrapping up the contents of the Mishkan for travels, the end of Parshat Bamidbar. As the Torah tells us, they're not allowed to approach Har Sinai at the time of Matan Torah. V'tziva u'shmartem et mishmeret ha-kodesh v'et mishmeret ha-mizbeach, kasher amar sham, v'gam ha-kohanim ani Hashem la-Hashem yitkadashu, v'akohanim v'ama al yersu lalot la-Hashem pen yifrotz bam. There too, the Kohanim are told to protect the Kodesh and the Mizbeach, the keeping literally of the Kodesh and the Mizbeach, as the rules similarly were. At Har Sinai, everybody had to be purified and no one was allowed to go in. Why is all this going on, says Ramban? And it's remarkable how much time he spends introducing this small segment of this large book of Bamidbar. The entire introduction is in front of you. You can see how much space he's spending on a very, very few chapters. All these rules and regulations about taking care of the Mishkan, taking care of the vessels, the encamping around it, the traveling around it, all of these things, vakol ma'alala mikdash v'chavodlo, dignity and reverence and sanctity for the mikdash. Kemosh amru chazal, he quotes the chazal, that the palace of a king, which has very finely dressed guards standing around it, think of the guards we may have seen in London at various locations, is much nicer than the same very handsome palace which doesn't have these finely attired protectors. And this is the metaphor that he uses for the Mishkan. And now at the very end he says, you know, I've got four more lines to write in my Hakdama. Maybe I should say something about the rest of Sefer Bamidbar. Va'sefer hazeh kulo b'mitzvot sha'ah shenitztavu behem ba'omdam bamidbar. The entire book, Ramban is saying this, so if you have any questions, you'll take it up with Ramban, not with me. The entire book deals with temporary mitzvot, which were given for the Israelites in the desert. Ubanisim ha-na'asim lahem l'saper kol ma'aseh Hashem asher asay mahem lafli, and to relate the miracles which were performed for them in characterizing the wondrous acts by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'siper ki heichel latetoi behem lifnehem lecharev, and along the way we are told that God began to present their enemies for slaughter in their path, v'tzivaich teichalei ka'aretz lehem, how the land is to be divided, v'eim b'sefer hazeh mitzvot nohagot l'dorot, Zulatik tzat mitzvot binyanei korbanot. There are no mitzvot in this book which pertain to ongoing generations, as opposed to mitzvot sha'ah in the Midbar, which probably refers to the things like the things pertaining to the Mishkan, as well as, let's say, a mitzvah like Pesach Sheni, which came up in the desert and belonged right in the context, or the mitzvah to send out those who are ritually impure from the camp, shiluach min hamachaneh for tmeim. So those things are appropriate in the Midbar. But mitzvot ledorot, says Ramban, there are only a few of them having to do with korbanot. Now there actually are a few mitzvot about korbanot. For example, almost, well, a large chunk of Parashat Pinchas deals with korbanot, the korbanot musaf that we offer on holidays and Rosh Chodesh and Shabbat, in addition to the Korban Tamid. But there is one. Actually, you have the Korbanot of the Nazir, and you have an Asham Gzeilot, which is found in the Parsha in Parshat Naso as well. But that's all there are in mitzvot Dorot, because Shetchil Bahen B'Sefer HaKohanim, the Torah began in Vayikra, V'lo Nishlam Be'Ran Sham V'Shliman B'Sefer Hazeh. The Torah didn't finish them there, finished them up here. Now, Ramban sets the book, as I said, in the context of Sefer Vayikra. The standard comparison with Har Sinai, we've seen. But let me ask you, why don't you ask me, or ask Ramban, has he been reading the same Sefer Bamidbar that we've been reading? And Ramban is one of the smartest people that I know. This is, the question, it perplexes me much more because it's Ramban. And because I know very well that he could take the Chumash, and maybe without taking it, and tell me all the things that are discussed in this Sefer. And he would know very, very well that there is a good deal of material which is in this Sefer, which are mitzvot ledorot. For example, Sota, Nazir, the parts that are not Korban related necessarily, the laws of Nazirut, Birkat Kohanim, the laws of Chala, which the Torah very explicitly says is Lidorot, the laws of Nesachim, Tzitzit, the laws of Matnot Kehuna, the gifts for the priesthood that we find in Korah, Parah Aduma, the laws of vows, Nidarim, in the beginning of Parshat Matot, laws about Tumah v'Tahara of Kelim that we find in Matot, laws about destroying idolatry, destroying the Canaanites, laws about Arei Miklat, laws of murder. There's a rather lengthy list of laws which are Lidorot, and which, for whatever reason, Ramban does not refer to. But that's not what bothers me the most, because after all, how you count which mitzvot are surprisingly omitted or not, we could argue perhaps Ramban doesn't have to give a picture of the entire store, of the entire survey. I mean, after all, we can read Bamidbar, we don't have to read Ramban, he doesn't have to tell me. But there's something else that's missing. Like, what did he do with Bahalotcha through Chukat, more or less Perek Yud Aleph through Perek Kaf Aleph approximately? Where did it go? Sefer Bamidbar, among other things, is the story of a series of crises faced by Am Yisrael and their leader Moshe Rabbeinu in the desert, a series of rebellions, a series of failures on the part of the people. Im Yirtzeh Hashem, in a couple of weeks, we will be focusing on one of those parashiyot. But where is all this in Ramban? Ramban focuses completely on the positive, on the high points, on that which is, forward-looking, and omits any discussion of the story of the Tav Erah, Kivrot HaTa'ava, Miriam Aharon and Moshe, Miriam's punishment, the Meraglim, Korach, Mei Meriva. There's Baal Pa'or, b'chulei b'chulei. There's an awful lot of Sefer Bamidbar that, for whatever reason, here Ramban didn't tell me why he didn't say it, so I'm not going to be able to tell it to you. But I just want you to notice that here we have one of the greatest medieval exegetes choosing to be extremely selective in the way in which he chooses to introduce the book. accentuate the positive and avoid the negative is how I would characterize it. And no, on the contrary, because on the contrary, well, you have only what is it, three mitzvot in Breishit. So he's obviously not going to be concerned. And the Hakdamah to Breishit, if you remember, is also the Hakdamah to Torah. So the whole thing plays out differently, although he does focus on the role which Sefer Bereishit plays. You know, he talks about that Torah must refer to the stories in Bereishit, Shimorata, Nashim, Baderech HaEmet, or something like that, in terms of the function of the narratives and what is to be learned from them. But certainly here, at least this is a passage which always struck me, and what I think is very interesting. And here sometimes we get to see who's been reading what. When we read Abarbanel, I think we're going to realize that Abarbanel had read Ramban and was coming to fix what might have been omitted, or coming to include that which might have been omitted in Ramban. I mean, and this is not a question of intellectual history. There's no doubt that Abarbanel was sitting with Ramban in front of him. I mean, you can see that from his Perush all the way. But here, in the way that he writes his Hakdama, I think that's interesting. It occurred to me that one might have suggested that Ramban is focusing on the beginning of the Sefer, because those first, you know, nine lines really do talk about only the opening chapters. But he then skips to the equivalent, let's say, the war with Sichon and Og and Nachala and the Parsha of Korbanot, all of which come much later. So I can't really, you know, justify Ramban by saying he's focusing only on the beginning, because he does introduce the material from later on as well. All right, let's turn a couple of centuries down and take a look and see how Abarbanel sets it. His introduction actually puts the Sefer in a slightly larger frame than Ramban does, and is actually interested, as we might be, in looking at the structure at the larger units out of which we might say that Sefer B'Midbar might be composed. All right. Let's read this. I apologize for not having a better text available of Abarbanel to photocopy. This is already enlarged. All right. The first book of the Torah, Sefer Bereishit, comes to delineate the genealogy of the Israelites and their families from the beginning of creation until they enter into the Egyptian exile. I'm at the end of line one. And the second book, Shemot, comes to, by the way, you know, I'm going to say Bamidbar or Bamidbar, depending on what I remember to say. And you all know that the book is called, in English, of course, the Book of Numbers. And usually we don't really worry about what a book is called, but for our discussion this evening, we are going to find out that the name of the book is actually going to be very significant for one approach that's going to be taken to it. By the way, the name of the Book of Numbers is actually the name by which Chazal called it, Chomesh HaPkudim. The English names for the books of Chumash are the names that Chazal used. They didn't call them Bereishit, Shemot, and so on. Nevertheless, here he's just using numbers. HaSefer HaSheni comes to teach the exile and the physical redemption, Gulat HaGufaniyit, Gufaniyit perhaps, Mishibud Mitzrayim, and the spiritual redemption, Mishibushei Emunatam, from the nonsense of the beliefs that they had, V'nigalu Mehem, the Ma'amad Har Sinai, from which the Israelites were redeemed at Revelation. Ve'ech nitztavu al melechet ha-mishkan la'ashrot b'nehem ha-shchina ha-elohit. Of course, that's a large chunk of the end of Sefer Shemot. Ha-sefer ha-shlishi, the third book, Vayikra, comes to teach about Kedusha, Tohorah, Avodah, which they should carry out in the temple in order to preserve God's presence among them. La'atmid ha-shchina b'nehem. V'zeh imba kohanim mishartei Hashem v'imba mo bichlal. This pertains both to the limited group, to the priesthood, as well as to the larger group, the people, Bazharat kol hadvarim hametoavim v'haraim, because Am Yisrael, by being told to keep away from revolting, disgusting things, whether in the context of kashrut or other things, they too are elevated in a certain sense to a level that one might call priestly, in terms of the maintenance of a level of a purity. V'achar shishlim kol zeh, after he finishes all of this, and now we're at the introduction to Bamidbar. Ba sefer harvi'i, l'saper seder hanhagat ha'am. The fourth book, Bamidbar, comes to teach the conduct of the people. Eich haya Bamidbar b'mas'eihem v'chaniyatam. How it was in the desert during their traveling and during their camping. If I had to pick two words which characterize Sefer Bamidbar, one of the sets of two words that I would choose would be Nasa and Chana, to travel and to camp. And it's not accidentally that I picked them, because I happen to know that of the verb Chana, more than half of its occurrences in Tanakh occur in Sefer Bamidbar, and 60% of the occurrences of the verb to travel, Nasa, occur in Sefer Bamidbar. Of course, the list in the beginning of Maaseh Vayisu Vayachnu does help a lot in that calculation. Nevertheless, those two words do express, in a certain sense, the theme, or one of the themes, of the Sefer, and you see how Abarbanel begins with it, although he's not playing my concordance game. Ve'et kol atla asher mitza'atam baderech, the various distress, forms of distress which they experienced. Vasiba asher ba'avura nitakvu ba'midbar 40 shana tom kol ador yoheyotzim mimitzrayim, and the reason that they get stuck in the desert for 40 more years. Vasher eira lekorach va'adato asher hitzua Moshe ala haron. It's almost as if he and Ramban didn't read the same book. Notice that Abarbanel, in his listing, is choosing to list those very elements which Ramban seems to have omitted in his. Va'agav grara, and along the way, ba'u betoch advarim ha'elu l'sibot sheyit ba'aru shama, there come in the middle of these narratives, for good reasons which will be explained at the proper time, mitzvot miyuchadot lidorot, right? Mitzvah tzitzit u'para aduma v'seder nachalot u'birkat kohanim v'sotav v'nazir minchat olam v'sachem atmidin v'sfeyem odot u'nidarim v'arei miklat u'matnot huna u'lviya u'mishmartam u'fkudatam. I didn't have to read my list. I could have read Abarbanel's list. So you see, and this makes me fairly suspicious that Abarbanel is wondering what was going through Ramban's mind, perhaps, and starts out his approach by taking the very opposite tack from Ramban, perhaps. V'seder masa'am, and the arrangement, the order of the travel, v'hakol b'chokhma u'v'hanaga Elohit. So he's now set out the broad topics of the book, focusing, as I said, on the ones that Ramban did not, as well as a list of the mitzvot l'dorot. V'hasefer hazeh, gives a correction in the margin, yesh bo asara sedarim. Interesting. He looks at the fact that there are 10 sedras, 10 parashiyot. Now, we all know very well, or if you didn't, you're about to find out, that not always and not everywhere was Kriyat HaTorah completed annually with the 10 sedras that we have. We know very well that at a certain time, at least in Eretz Yisrael, Kriyat HaTorah was covered in 3 years, not in 1 year. And this, obviously, the amount you read each Shabbat was much shorter than what's read today, and which we're more familiar with. Nevertheless, Abarbanel looks at these 10 sedarim and says they can be divided up very, very neatly. L'hagid eichai tahan agat Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha-shalom et ha'am biyotam ba-midbar v'chol ma'asei tokpam u'gvuratam v'seder mas'am u'machanehem u'mochamotehem, all of the things that Moshe did in the leadership, we're being told, u'mashe karalem im Moav u'midyan balak u'bilam u'lchemet sichon v'og ma'chei ha'mori matnat artsam l'ruvein v'gad v'chatsi shevet ha'menashe. Even when he talks about some of the other narrative, he focuses on the little pieces that Ramban sort of left out. Even the positive things Ramban didn't mention explicitly. Ushaar ha'inyanim ad boam el ha'menucha ve'el ha'nachala. And various other things until they get to the final resting place that they're going to. Ha'omnam asara sedarim ha'ele. Indeed, these 10 sedarim can be divided up yitchalku lishnei chalakim. Vaya chelek harishon mechamisha sedarim harishonim. The first part would be the first 5 sedras parshiot. What's the theme of the first 5? And let's just again, Bamidbar, Naso, Bahalotcha, Shlach, and Korach. B'sipur kol tla'otam biyotam Bamidbar. The first 5 are the troubles they had going through the desert. V'heim, and he then lists them. V'achelak hashini, b'chamisha starim anisharim. The second part is the last 5. Zot chukat, Balak, Pinchas, Matot, and Mas'ei. this will yisaper bo ma shekara lehem bimei hamelchamot mishehigiyu el eretz noshavet. So they divide themselves up into the travail of the desert wandering through Korach and the adventures and wars of Am Yisrael from the time they reach somewhat civilized territory. You really want to move the divider someplace late in Parshat Chukat, actually, the beginning of Chukat. Well, Chukat is the 40th year. Chukat is going to be a critical dividing point because it's clear that, I'll talk about the dates a little bit later. Rishonim are not going to talk about this, but I'll talk a little bit about the dates that Sefer Bamidbar gives us and how we should think about the adventures, as it were, chronologically. Chukat is already year 40. Aharon dies in Perakaf Aleph Pasuk Kafchet, if I'm not mistaken. And although the date is not given there, it's given in Maaseh, in Perak Lamed Gimel, and we're told that Aharon dies on Rosh Chodesh Av of year 40. So I know that at that point I'm already in year 40. And the adventures with Sichon and Og and so on carry on after that. So the last four and a half, at least, of the Parshiyot quite clearly belong to the later adventures. The question is, where do we put Parah Aduma? But let's say we'll accept the Barbanos division. In a way, he does resolve some of the difficulties that we saw with Ramban. We see he looks at the Sefer a little bit differently. and he does sort of step back and look at larger units without focusing on a particular area, as Ramban focused on the segment pertaining to the Mishkan. Now, the third introduction that I want to look at, again, is that of Netziv, who is an exegete with, say, some Kabbalistic overtones. Ramban, of course, is the great Mekubal as well, but it didn't creep in at all into his Hakdama. Here we may see a little bit more of Kabbalistic things, which we will then avoid discussing very carefully. but his insights, even the ones that may come with a Kabbalistic spin, are extremely valuable for Pshuto Shel Mikra. And Netziv, one of the important things that the 19th century Parshanim did, and there's a whole stream of them that start really with the Vilna Gaon at the end of the 18th century and go through the early 20th century Mefarshim. Many of them, challenged by things like Reform and Haskalah, struggled very hard to integrate Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh to show, and to this group belong commentators like the Ravid HaZahav and the Ktava Kabbalah and the Malbim and the Meshech Chochman. I'm going to leave out the Torah Tmimah. I don't want to give a full list because I'm going to probably leave out somebody by accident. But there is a whole group of commentators, Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman later on in the end of the 19th century belongs to the group as well, who are working very hard on this linking or this integration of Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, which they see as one of their main goals in terms of the challenge of Parshanut for their day. And Netziv is already living at the end of the 19th century and has a certain sophistication as a reader. I don't know how much modernity has impinged upon him, but you see things already. He starts to see things now and then a bit differently. Let's see how he introduces the Sefer. I actually was very both pleased and disappointed many years ago when I discovered that my own favorite characterization of Sefer Bamidbar, which I thought I had invented, not only is it Netziv, but it's actually found in Chazal as well. But it was in Netziv where I tripped across it. Zeh Sefer Nikra B'fi HaTana Chomesh HaPkudim V'nirsham B'dat Rabotenu Inyan Shnei HaPkudim Shebazeh HaSefer Yoter Mishaarei Dvarim Shemiyuchadim Bazeh HaSefer. Netziv starts out with the name. He says, this is the Book of Numbers. And when Chazal call it Chomesh HaPkudim, the Book of Numbers, they aren't being casual. They're focusing on something which to them is very significant in the construction of the Sefer. Okay. Because there are two countings in the book. There's one which takes place early on, and there's one that takes place in Parshat Pinchas. In fact, there's one which takes place in year 2, and there's one which takes place in year 40. And the two countings, suggests Netziv, frame the adventures of Am Yisrael in the desert, and therefore the book is called Chumash HaPkudim. Whether or not his analysis is pshat in Chazal, I don't know, but it's certainly a very interesting way in which he sets up. We'll see in a moment how he uses this. Other things are unique: Meraglim, Birkat Bilam, Va'od Harbei, Mishum. The Ikar Zeh HaSefer, the central point of this book, Hu HaMachalif U'Mishnei Halichot Am Hashem B'Chayei HaOlam Me'az Shehigiu La'Eretz Yisrael Min HaDerech Shehalchu BaMidbar. The transition and the change of the progress of God's people in life on earth from the time they got to Eretz Yisrael, different from the way they conducted themselves in the desert. In other words, Sefer Bamidbar is the transition, as I, and we'll say it in the Tzibbel, say it later, between the generation which left Egypt and the generation which enters Eretz Yisrael. And the goal of the Sefer is to portray this transition and to highlight this transition. Shebamidbar ayu mitnagim b'midat tiferet, shehalach liyamin Moshe shulegamrei lemalai mehalichot hateva. In the desert, they are being conducted in a supernatural fashion. Uve'eretz Yisrael alchu b'derech hateva b'sitrei hashgachat malchut shamayim baruch hu. And in Eretz Yisrael, they are operating under natural law with the concealed hashgacha providence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the desert is l'mala miderech hateva, Eretz Yisrael is b'derech hateva, v'zeh ha'shinui hitchil odam b'midbar b'shnat ha'arba'im kemo shebayarnu b'parshat chukat. The transition, the change, took place in the 40th year, as we shall explain, or as we have explained, in Parshat Chukat. Netziv actually says in a number of places, and I think he says even in the Hakdama here, that the reason for the change starts earlier. Earlier in the desert wanderings, we'll see Netziv saying that Bnei Yisrael are having trouble living up to a supernatural accompaniment, that every moment they're under the gun, as it were, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kaviyachol, if I may use human terminology, is walking right in the middle of their camp with them. And God is just too close for comfort, and they can't handle it. And he points out that one of the reasons that punishments come so quickly is because they're operating l'malami of Derech HaTeva, and they eventually say to Moshe, no, this is a little bit too much. Remember what they said after God speaks to them directly, it's the same sort of thing. And he says the wars are natural. You know, they take an army, they go up, they fight. Moshe doesn't go up to the top of the mountain, raise up his hands to God, and when Moshe raises his hands, Israel is triumphant. The war is now b'derech hateva. He sends out, you know, whether he sends out Pinchas to Midian or he sends out the army against Sichon and Og, it's done b'derech hateva. Okay, the mateh he didn't carry it all the time. Apparently, Nesiv thinks that's part of it as well. I couldn't have said it better myself, right? Sefer Bamidbar divides the Exodus generation from the conquest generation. I don't want to get involved in detail in the fact how he describes that the different countings work this way. They're counted according to the Galim, and Ephraim comes before Menashe, whereas in the second counting it's different, and so on and so forth. There's obviously a bit of Kabbalistic influence on his analysis here, and also I'm not convinced that it's Al-Pi Pshat. He's absolutely correct that about the Pshat phenomenon of about the transition. I'm not sure that you can prove it from the Pkudim. And if we go down a couple of lines, Mishum Hachi, therefore Rashum Zeha Inyan Ma'od Asheru Chazal Likroshem La Sefer Chomesh HaPkudim. This made such an impression on Chazal that they called the Book of Numbers. And then he points out that according to Chazal, Vahibin Soa, that little parsha with the inverted, reversed nuns, is a Sefer Bifnei Atzmo. And that's what divides up the part of Bamidbar, I'll put it in my terms, the part of Bamidbar that belongs to Har Sinai from the part of Bamidbar that goes wandering off into the desert. L'lamdenu, yibatchalat ha-shinui haya min vayhi ha'am kimit onanim. See, here he says the beginning of the shinui already starts with the first rebellion, with the first grumbling in Perek Yud Aleph. Ki bishvil shitnagu b'midat tiferet nen shum yad achar shechatu. God was right there, midat tiferet, supernatural. They're punished immediately. Ki hayat zel hashgacha yadiminam. The davar ze haya kasha lehem lisbol. They couldn't handle it. Ad she garam lishiluach meraglim kasher yivawar resh parshat shlach. U'mizeh nishtalshel v'halach ad shigia lezeh shinui kasher yivawar sham. There is a continuing degeneration, the degeneration perhaps, which leads finally to the shift by God of the way in which he led them. Vimkein parsha zok tanahi yamechaleket bein shnei ofanei halichot Yisrael, ad shekol chilek echad min hasefer hu sefer b'fnei atzmo, kemo zeh hiluch hu sefer b'fnei atzmo, v'zeh hiluch hu sefer b'fnei atzmo. So I have three parts, excuse me, to the sefer, and each of them is a book, is a unit by itself. So what Netziv has done, going beyond, in a sense, Abarbanel and Ramban, not giving the summary as they did, but instead looking at what I would call the narrative function of Sefer Bamidbar. What role does Sefer Bamidbar play in the story, in the narrative of Torah? And we see that he characterizes it as, number one, a generational shift, number two, a shift in the nature of divine guidance, and this will play a role in his commentary. He will focus on it from time to time. Notice there are no comments at all about the legal material. Netziv is focused actually on the sefer, almost to the exclusion of the contents of the sefer. He says almost nothing about the actual contents of the sefer, because what he wants to do is understand how this sefer is working without getting involved in details. We'll see next time, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, and the topic that I'm talking about next time will actually grow fairly organically out of what I'm going to say shortly. The topic will be law, narrative, and the land in the book of Bamidbar. We will see how the legal material, among other things, we'll see how the legal material in the Sefer helps paint the same picture of transition, helps paint the same picture of the movement from the generation of Yitziat Mitzrayim to the generation of Knisa La'aretz, Ve'en kan makom la'arich, because then you wouldn't come next week. So we've seen how the three exegetes, each in his own way, has contributed to our understanding of the Sefer. I think we've benefited simply by the different ways in which they have, the different vantage points which they've taken in presenting the Sefer, and presenting Sefer Bamidbar. And the aspects that each one highlighted are different, and perhaps we can see better than all of them by putting the three of them together, and I think that's always some value. But what I'd like to do now, as I move into my own introduction, and as I said, some of my links with Netziv should be obvious, I think it's important to look at and to focus on certain aspects of the biblical book, on certain issues and certain facts which did not make a sufficient impact on earlier parshanim that they would make them part of their introductions. At times we might find a passing comment in a commentary that will allude to the same kind of comment that I'm going to make as an introduction, and this goes back again to the question of, you know, what are we doing in an introduction? We're looking to look at some perhaps larger literary structures, and we're going to want to make the reading of a biblical book and the rereading of a biblical book more useful and more meaningful. And here I have to digress for just a moment. And I'm going to tell you something very, very important that sounds very, very trivial. But believe me, it's very important. And that is, it's a simple fact that you can only read a book for the first time once. Sometimes you can't even read it once for the first time because you know the story. And I cannot emphasize this enough. I'll explain to you why I'm raising it here in the context of Sefer Bamidbar. But I will give you my own personal favorite example of this elsewhere. Once you know the story of Megillat Rut, once you read Megillat Rut for the first time, all of the drama and all of the suspense which is built up at certain points and the false endings which are supposed to grab you no longer grab you because you know what's going to happen in the end. So, when Boaz and Ruth in the field are having their very dry but theoretically impassioned dialogue, and Boaz says, everybody knows what a virtuous woman you are, and of course I will go along with your whole suggestion. And he continues, "Va'ataki omnam ki goel anochi v'gam yesh goel karov mimeni." However, there is another redeemer who comes ahead of me, and the audience groans. But the audience doesn't groan because we know the story. If you're reading that story for the first time, that has to hit you. You're all ready for everything to come to a happy conclusion, and then he says, "Wait a minute." And then we go on. The author of Ruth is good at this, right? Now we move to the city. I was going to get something. We're close enough to Shavuos. We can talk about Ruth, right? We're at the city gate. We're there. I'm the Edad. Boaz has gathered, and he says, "You know, let me." He says to the Goel, "Egleos nechal lemor kinei neged eishvim neged zikne amim tigal ga'avim lo tigal hagid ali gadakin zutchal ligol vanochi acharecha vayomer." Okay, anochi agal. I'll do it. Oh my God, what's going to happen to the story? This neatly, what's going on here? It makes no impact on us. It makes no impact on us because we know that in a moment within Tanakh, because the story is just too well known to us. Megillat Esther is another good example. It's a wonderful suspense story, except that you're told the story before you ever read it. And you know that everything is going to turn out fine in the end. Okay, what does this have to do with Sefer Bamidbar? And the answer is that when you're studying Sefer Bamidbar and Sefer Breshit and Sefer Shemot and Vayikra and Bamidbar until we get to Perek Yud Gimel, you are supposed to be operating under the notion that Bnei Yisrael are about to enter Eretz Yisrael. You don't, because we know the story. There actually are some hints in Torah earlier, and I will admit it says, "Achlu et haman arba'im shana ad bo'am el eretz no shavet." Yeah, there may be an echo here or there, but the thrust of the story is, the narrative line of the story, forget the narrator's comment, right? The narrative line of the story is that they're about to enter Eretz Yisrael, and that's critical to our reading of Sefer Bamidbar, as we'll see in greater detail next week. But we lose all of that. We lose focus on that because we know what happens afterward. And indeed, we're expected to read and reread and the like, but because all our readings are second and later readings, we are prevented from reading the first half of Bamidbar with the proper attitude. And, you know, I just want to highlight this because I really believe it's very, very important, and it's important in other Sfarim of Tanakh as well, in narratives. Where we know the end of the story, it's very hard for us to erase our knowledge. But if we can erase our knowledge, if we can suspend our knowledge, we are going to see much more in the text, and we're going to be sensitive to much more in the text than we are if not. How does Sefer Bamidbar fit into the Torah? How does it connect with what precedes, and how does it connect with what follows? Well, we can ask a simple question and begin with, where does the book of Bamidbar begin? And this will help us talk about earlier material, and we'll talk about links forward and links backward. So let me present this. How many dates are there in the book of Bamidbar, and what is their distribution? Now, most of the dates in Bamidbar are going to be in chronological order, although it happens to be the book of Bamidbar supplies the one very, very clear example of what we call Ein Mukdam Umuchar Batorah. And it's very, very explicit, because Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, is the first of the second month of the second year. And we know very well that the parasha of Pesach, Pesach Sheni, which is in Perek Tet, Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk He, gives me the dates Rosh Chodesh Nisan of the second year and Yudalad Nisan of the second year. So it's clear, and the one place, to my knowledge, in Shas, which talks about Ein Mukdam Mukhar Batorah, which is very common in Rashi and in Midrash, in one place in Shas, actually deals with this particular case. And as Ramban points out, as you know, Ramban is the exegete who denies that you can just go around saying Ein Mukdam Mukhar Batorah. He says only when the Torah makes it explicit to you, V'gam Sham Letzorech Inyan Ulatam Nachon, there's got to be a good reason for saying it, and the Torah has to be fairly explicit about it. Of course, this is the example. But let's take all of that together. The Sefer begins Rosh Chodesh Iyar. We can actually date the Sefer. It's the anniversary. Very good. We are here at the anniversary of Sefer Bamidbar, the second year of, they didn't call it Iyar in those days, in the second year of leaving, after leaving Egypt. There is then a reference in Perek Zayin, Pasuk Aleph, Vahi biyom kalot Moshe lakim et hamishkan. Now, we know that biyom kalot Moshe lakim et hamishkan, according to Shmot Perek Mem, Pasuk, that's a false reference. Perek Mem, Pasuk Beit, it says Yud Beit, but it's not Pasuk Beit, biyomach, God tells Moshe to set up the Mishkan on the first of the first month. And then we read Vayi b'chodesh harishon b'shana shenit b'echad l'chodesh hukam ha'mishkan in Yud Zayin. There in Perek Mem of Shmot. So it's quite clear that we have again a slight out of order here, although it's not explicit in the text here in Bamidbar. We then have the material in Perek Tet, which talks about the Nisan, and the material in Perek Yud, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Again, I know dates are the worst thing. Yud Yud Aleph Vahi Bashana Shenit Bachodesh Hashini Besrim Bachodesh Na'alah Anan Bal Mishkan Haidut. The travels, the actual traveling itself, begins on the 20th of Iyar in year 2. That's the last date that you get in Sefer Bamidbar until you get to Perek Lamed Gimel Pasuk Lamed Chet, which tells you, as I mentioned earlier, that Aharon HaKohen dies in the 40th year, B'chodesh HaChamishi Be'achad LaChodesh, on Rosh Chodesh Av of, that's right, of year 40. Notice then, that from the standpoint of the way the story is told to us, we have a series of events which are dateless. Whether we talk about Taveira, Mitonanim, Miriam, Shlach, Korach, Chukat, until the death of Aharon. And the death of Aharon takes place, as I said, in Perek Kaf Pasuk Kafchet. The material is dateless. The narrative, all of the adventures, are told without reference to chronological fixity. And we work with certain presumptions. I mean, Chazal, for example, work with the presumption that the story, we're basically given, and this is important for how we read Bamidbar, we are given stories of the beginning and stories of year 40. Because Shlach follow, everything follows up. If you do Chazal's calculations, in order for Meraglim coming back to be Tisha B'Av, B'chiyah L'dorot, and so on and so forth, that's all the first year, the second year, right? It's all going to be, Meraglim ends, we go from here, Perek Yud Aleph, and from 20 Iyar to Tisha B'Av is Balotcha and Shlach, the beginning of Shlach. Where Korach fits in is an interesting question. Most Rishonim take it as belonging to the first generation. You will, there's a fairly obscure mitzudat in Tehillim, showed to me by my good friend Reb Shalom Karmi a long time ago, who suggests that Korach belongs to the second generation, although certainly this is a very, very minority view. It looks like Korach belongs to the first part as well, although it's the very fact that Torah doesn't give us dates and doesn't give us location, you know, in terms of chronology, that enables a certain amount of flexibility. And think about it. Where are they when Bamidbar ends? Right? Chronologically, where are they? No, that's geographically. That's very good. IS chronology, that's Tano geography, or whatever. So, they're on, which, okay, and Moshe's final address begins Rosh Chodesh Shvat of year 40. Right? One of the reasons we lose sense of chronology is that Sefer Dvarim takes 5 weeks. It takes longer to read it than it takes to have it. Sefer Dvarim runs from Rosh Chodesh Shvat to Zayin Adar, assuming that Moshe died on Zayin Adar, which is the standard view, as opposed to the fact that he died on Zayin Shvat, which is one fairly obscure view in the Sifrei. But if we assume the standard view, we have just about 5 weeks for all of Dvarim. You're right, the Torah doesn't give us any dates. But except I know that it's got to be, by Nisan they're already going across. I can use Sefer Yehoshua to help me with the dating somewhat, so I don't have that much leeway to go from Shvat of the 40th year. How much further can I go? Because in Pesach already, they're already in Eretz Yisrael. So it's still not a very long time. However you want to play with the statistic, you know, with the dates between between Shvat and Nisan, nevertheless, it's not a very long time. But what does this do to us? Is it forces us not to think about the way Bamidbar really lies. Bamidbar contains virtually the entire narrative of the years in the desert from the time that they leave Sinai, because Dvarim is recapitulation. And the actual telling is just that. And this is why the dates, their both their presence as well as their absence, lends, I think, a very important guideline in the way we're going to look at the Sefer. Another point of reference I'll suggest is geographical. You anticipated very well. Notice the last line of Sefer Vayikra. Ela ha-mitzvot asher tziva Adonai et Moshe el b'nei Yisrael b'har Sinai. Right? These are the mitzvot which God commanded Moshe at Sinai. The last line of Sefer Bamidbar. Ela ha-mitzvot va-mishpatim asher tziva Adonai biyad Moshe el b'nei Yisrael ba'arvot Moav al Yarden Yerecho. Those two lines, again, point to the significance of Bamidbar as the point of movement, as the shift from Har Sinai, where parenthetically they should be about to go into Eretz Yisrael shortly, to Arvot Moav al Yarden Yerecho, where once again they are supposed to be about to enter Eretz Yisrael shortly. So again, the geographical point of reference, as described in those two final psukim, shows a movement from mitzvot in one place, mitzvot in the other place. A literary point of reference, point of contact. And this is, I think, particularly significant. If we look at Shmot Perek Mem, and you can see why I commented that the kind of thing that I'm looking for is not what Rishonim are looking for in introductions. And mine may not be as valuable if it weren't for theirs, but once we have theirs, this is also going to be of some use. The last five psukim of Sefer Shmot. The Anan covers the Ohel Moed, Kvod Hashem Maleh Tamishkan, When the Anan lifted itself from the tabernacle, the Israelites traveled. If it did not lift itself, they did not travel until it did, because the cloud of the Lord was on the Mishkan by day, and at night there would be fire there. Interesting, a very glorious conclusion to the book of Shemot. Now look in Bamidbar, Perek Tet, Pasuk Tetvav. notice. No, no, I'm not up to that yet. That's Yud Lamed Hey, or something like that. Notice the point of reference in Tet Vav. Uviyom Hakim Et HaMishkan. I'm now back at Rosh Chodesh Nisan of Shmot Perek Mem, as I indicated earlier. The cloud covered the Mishkan, and in the evening there would be fire. This is how it always would be. The cloud would cover it, and fire by night. And whenever the cloud lifted itself from the tabernacle, the Israelites would travel. They would encamp wherever it landed. Right? They traveled at God's command. They camped at God's command. As long as the cloud was on the Mishkan, they would camp. If it was there for a long time or a short time, they would only travel when the Anan went up. Sometimes it would be a short time, sometimes a long time, and so on and so forth. They would travel and camp at God's command, keeping God's mishmeret. Notice how similar those two parashiot are, those two little segments are. Both of them on Rosh Chodesh Nisan of year 2, and both describing, indeed the one in Bamidbar is more elaborate than the one in Shmot, both describing what was the process of the traveling. What does this do from a literary standpoint? It makes Sefer Vayikra into a gigantic parenthesis in which time is suspended. Time doesn't move forward in Sefer Vayikra. It's almost, I know there are little stories, I mean, I understand that. I mean, there's already 8 days later. It's not the point. The point is that I have, in effect, a book of law in Vayikra where time doesn't move. It's almost as if I have to, you know, have some kind of split screen. Sefer Vayikra was going on while a whole bunch of things at the end of Shemot were going on or something like that. Because already here, the Torah, by using the same language, and there are other examples of this technique in other literatures, Lahavdil as well, where the repetition of a scene quite a ways after its original occurrence will indicate that what's happened in between has been happening simultaneously with the story that's been going on. And this also gives us a certain focus, a certain way of looking at the narrative. It may tell us something about Sefer Vayikra, by the way, maybe just as important for Vayikra, but it also tells me that in a certain sense, when I look for where does Bamidbar start, I don't look at Vayikra, but I should look at Shmot. And Ramban looked at Vayikra because he's looking at certain legal material, and I say, looking at the text itself and looking at the nature of the narrative, I say, this is going to go back to Shmot. Needless to say, we'll see other examples where there's a good deal of connection. So you see that there are tensions in the connections. The geography, somehow or other, looks like Vayikra is an appropriate place to move along from, but the literary frame connects with Shmot. I want to make one more sort of detailed observation and tie things together, perhaps respond to any questions there might be. There's one very interesting internal pointer, or two internal pointers, which I think we should pay attention to. Since we're in Perek Tet already, we should stay there. And what we read here it's not in Perek Tet, it's in Perek Yod. That's fine. You should always proofread your notes before you... Okay. Perek Yod, Pasuk Yod Aleph and following, is the first journey in the Midbar. And as I said, traveling is a good deal of Sefer Bamidbar. And here we get a detailed description, tribe by tribe, degel by degel, units of three tribes each, right? The packing up of the Mishkan, the putting it all together in great detail once. The story is only told once in detail. It's told here. This is what I call the first bookend. The second bookend is the opening of Parshat Mas'ei, where the Torah gives me a list, Vayisu Vayachanu, Vayisu Vayachanu, Vayisu Vayachanu. How are these bookends the same? They're not the same. And the answer is, whenever you see Vayisu Vayachanu, you're supposed to plug in mentally, as it were, the description here. The Torah only gives me the description of the travels once. Gives it to me here in Balotcha when we started out. But
that whole process, in a certain sense, you don't have to do it every time, obviously, but if you want to think about what Vayisu Vayachanu means, you have to take the description of Bahalotcha and realize that it repeats itself over and over in Parshat Mas'ei. And I think that if you look at the last line in that I referred to in Perek Yud, namely Pasuk Kafchet, Eile Mas'ei B'nei Yisrael L'tziv Otam V'yisa'u. Right? These are the travels L'tziv Otam, and they travel. And now I go to the beginning of Mas'ei, Eile Mas'ei B'nei Yisrael Asher Yatsu Me'eretz Mitzrayim L'tziv Otam V'yad Moshe V'aharon V'yichtom Moshe Et Motzaihem L'Mas'eihem Al Pi Adonai V'eile Mas'eihem L'Motzaihem. Once again, I get a fairly strong literary echo of the detailed travel scene that I find in Bahalotcha. I get as the introduction to the listed travel scene in Mas'ei. So here too, those two pieces, in a certain sense, frame the travelogue, frame the adventures in the desert between 20 ER of the second year to whatever date in the 40th year. It's already after the death of Aharon, so it's sometime between Av and Shvat in year 40. And again, these are the ways in which the Torah helps us make the connections, helps us see the structure of the Sefer. These two pointers, even though they're not mirror images, these two bookends of different natures, nonetheless enable us to take that part in between and say, this belongs together. It means that the first part of Bamidbar, however we're going to look at it, has connectives to Vayikra, has connectives perhaps less strongly back to Shmot. The later part of Mas'ei is already, you know, they're stationary. They're already in Arvot Moav. They've gotten where they're going. And the Torah shows it to us by what I call this beginning and ending. As I said, next time, hopefully, we'll take a sort of broader view of the narrative. I hope to be looking at the relationship of law and story, which is more significant, I believe, in Bamidbar than it is in Shmot, because you have this ongoing cutting back and forth between law and narrative, and to focus, as I said, particularly on the question of the role which Eretz Yisrael plays from several perspectives in the narrative of Sefer Bamidbar. And I'm quite happy now to entertain any questions which you may have.
You say that in Vayikra, time is suspended. All right, something like that.
Something like that.
Would we say pretty much the same thing about Sefer Devarim?
Yes. No, because it does move in time. I mean, you're right. What I say about Devarim is it covers a much shorter time than it appears to. But in Vayikra, if you allow for the bridge between the Rosh Chodesh Nisan passage at the end of Pekudei and the Rosh Chodesh Nisan passage in Bahalotcha, Vayikra is literally frozen in time. So you're right, the Dvarim takes very little time for a longer Sefer, but it isn't quite as suspended. You're right, it's also a Sefer which misleads us in terms of its chronological scope because of the length. Maybe. I mean, the comparison with Sinai. You know, that notion already is in Ramban. I think back in Shmot, where and he goes back and he uses it here. That doesn't help me with the problems I have with Ramban. But I think you're right that the way Ramban treats the Mishkan generally is quite consistent. And this is, you know, he thinks that the Mishkan is not, you know, an atonement and so on. Yeah, I think that's certainly the case. It should make us sensitive to the way in which the Torah is written and tells stories and integrates halacha into stories. Literary art standing alone, and I'm certainly one who thinks it's very important to be sensitive to these things. I'll plug myself. In the most recent issue of Tradition, I have a long essay on the question of literary approaches to the study of Tanakh. but I think that perception of the aesthetic alone is not a goal in itself. It form without meaning doesn't give me as much as form with meaning. And I would strive, once I become sensitive to the literary device, to see what is it doing for me in the telling of the story. Certainly, when I mean, aesthetic is important. In those cases in Root that I mentioned, for example, where being sensitive to the way the story is told and the use of suspense by the narrator gives me a heightened admiration for the narrative of Root. And that's a madriga. But I wouldn't necessarily argue that that's the be all, you know, the end. I'm there's one case in Bamidbar. I don't think I'll talk about it. But maybe I will. Actually, I may talk about it the following week. We'll see that a certain word keeps getting repeated in Perek Yud Aleph and Perek Yud Beit, the root Aleph Samach Pei, in all kinds of contexts. And for a long time, I wondered. I said to myself, I can't figure out what it's doing. I'm not sure I know now either, but at least I have an idea. But I can't figure out what it's doing. So at worst, I see what the Israelis following the Germans call a mila mancha, a leading word, and I see that it's playing through the section. I prefer if I can now show how it's doing something in the section, how it's meaningful, how it's useful. But it's I think it's sensitivity to structure and to looking at larger units. It's the very fact that we were able to look at Sefer Bamidbar and to look at connections or points of contact with Sefer Shmot, with Sefer Vayikra, and pointing towards Sefer Dvarim, makes us think about issues which are not the ones that we think of when we read Pasuk by Pasuk with Rashi or Ben Ezra or Ramban. I don't guarantee that any particular point that I made has a particular cure for a disease somewhere. But I think the way of reading, the developing of sensitivity towards some of these larger issues, I don't know if I want to call them literary, all of them. Some of them are other kinds of things. But the sensitivity to this will make us better students of Torah Shebichtav. It depends. Look, theoretically, yeah, but what happens when you find one you don't have the reason? So the answer is, thank you very much. And it goes back before them. You really have to go back to Meir Weiss and to Buber for earlier essays. I mean, certainly, Alter and Berlin and people like that have popularized it a lot now. But I mean, the Mila Mancha goes back to Meir Weiss and to Buber, and where we can. I mean, we don't throw it away just because we can't explain it. But you collect them, and once in a while, a student is going to tell me what it means. I can show you that it's there. Now my student will tell me what it's doing there. We shouldn't discount the aesthetic. Sometimes simply the elegance of phrase or the elegance of the way to say something may in itself be the if I may put it coarsely. Shalote Torah Tenu Kisichav Teila Shalahem, right? I mean, if we expect secular, uninspired literature to be composed in a particular way and to have certain decorative and artistic devices, so if I see it in Torah, and worse comes to worse, I'll attribute it to Dibrat Torah B'Lashon Bnei Adam, if I use the expression. But I'll certainly go looking for the meanings. No doubt. I'm much happier when I can justify it. I can explain it. It's almost as if Sefer Bamidbar ends a unit in a certain way, because except. That, again, the opening of Sefer Dvarim, Dvarim is definitely different in a certain way. Even the I mean, the fact that you have, you know, the same ending by Yikra and Bamidbar is very, very striking. There is no clear cut. If I would have liked an Arvot Moav al Yarden Yerecho in the opening verse of Dvarim, you know, to create, you know, if I had been writing, you know, to create that literary link with the last, you know, with the last psukim. But it's clear that that's where Dvarim is located, though, and it all the way through you're getting that sense. So there is no sort of clear cut pointer, and since Dvarim is so different in that most of it is Moshe's farewell address, I think there's less room in the way the story is told. The links in Dvarim to the earlier Sfarim are going to be in comparing the story the way Moshe tells it and the way the Torah told it earlier. This is obviously goes back to Reb Kiva Reb Yishmael, if I'm not mistaken, the question of whether the mitzvos which are repeated later on, you know, why were they repeated, and was everything given in Ohel Moed and so on. I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's clear that Sefer Vayikra contains mitzvot, and that Sefer Bamidbar contains mitzvot, and some of the mitzvot in Bamidbar, particularly those at the end.
But you don't say, you know, part of Vayikra is already the end.
They haven't left.
Huh?
They haven't left.
Nothing. They haven't left at all.
No, they don't leave until Perek Yud Pasuk Yud Aleph in Bamidbar. That's they're frozen at Sinai. That's somehow that's that timeless piece. They're at Sinai for all of Vayikra. I mean, again, we don't think about it, but that's what they're not going to move until Perek Yud Pasuk Yud Aleph of Bamidbar. But that's again one of those things that when you stop to think about it, sort of the way you look at Vayikra now will change a little bit. Yeah. 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 Well, no, not with the numbers. But he says the fact that there are two countings, one at the beginning and one at the end, and it's not a singular counting, but there are two countings, and Kabbalistically he says that the differences between the ways in which the two countings are done reflect two different stances, two different approaches, and therefore are symbolic of the two modes of divine guidance which Bnei Yisrael have, one supernatural and one natural. If I remember correctly, and I don't think I've been through every Nitziv in Bamidbar, the Nitziv is a commentary that one should read slowly. I don't believe he goes into it. In terms of dealing with the numerology, I don't think he deals with it. That's the kind of observation that I can't explain, but I'm not going to throw out just because I can't explain it. And that's very interesting. You know, think about it. I mean, I'll give you something similar to that. It's very often asked, why are the tribes which are put on Har Grizim and on Har Eval, what's the choice based on? There was a brief article published a few years ago by a former student of mine who worked out that if you play properly computing for the Leviim being in the middle and some Leviim not, that the numbers of the tribes on each mountain, with those tribes being split, comes closest to being an exact 50-50 split than any other permutation. And he gives you a chart with all the permutations. I don't remember where it was published. Some very obscure place. But it's a remarkable tour de force. you know, to some he computer crunched all the numbers and took all the possible ways of adding it up and said these tribes, if I discount the number of, you know, Levium in the middle and I assume a certain population continuity, then I'm going to get, you know, 50.1% on one mountain, 49.9% on the other one. It's as good an explanation, as I know. So I never know what to do with things like this, especially when they didn't have numbers as we have. I don't know how they were writing them, and I don't know what that would mean. But nevertheless, the observation itself is a very interesting one.
It seems a little
Six and six, right? But no, because my friend claimed that his best reasoning was that this gives you half of the people on one and half of the people on the other, and it doesn't have to do with which ones were particularly where. That was the only way to get half and half. Okay, I mean, see you next week.